Hello, and welcome to Staff Training Best Practices. I realize this is an investment in your time to listen to this presentation, but I also know that it is an investment that will pay off for your staff and children in the future. Now, since this is not a live presentation, it's a recorded one, this is going to be shorter and the interactive portions won't be present. So with that, let's go on to slide number 2. And the goal of this presentation is to have an exceptional staff training that meets or exceeds current best practice. Now, best practice is in quotes because what is a best practice is a constantly moving target. But for present purposes, best practice simply means that people from around the world have looked at what is the best way to do something and have come upon what a consensus views as the quote-unquote right way to do it. So it's basically the best that anybody knows how. Now, you all have best practices, and so when you're going through this presentation, sort of view it as a checklist. You definitely have elements of your training that many other camps could learn from. Likewise, there are probably sections here that you might be able to learn from and adapt. So take it as a checklist. On to slide 3, coping with the realities. Okay, so there's over 100 studies and a dozen books, and you're not going to read any of them. But that's okay, because I've read all of them, and I'm going to summarize it all. Now, of course, since it is just a summary, I've just picked out what I thought were the major points, just sort of the mountaintops. We'll kind of be dancing along the mountaintops and not really covering all the depth underneath, which is necessary for a presentation such as this. However, I have carefully culled the points which I think are most useful and valid for camps and presented them here in as clear, concise, and consolidated way as possible. Second point here, simplistic answers are usually naive. This is a long presentation. It is necessarily long. It could be much shorter, but it wouldn't be as valuable. If someone's trying to tell you what are the best practices, what is the best way to train somebody to do darn near anything, you'd better hope that it's not really short, because people are complex and the simplistic answer is usually simplistic. But as we're going through, please relax. Don't try and memorize everything. The information is in the handout. You can listen to this over and over again. You can just review the PowerPoint presentation. And there's also a lot of other information in the handout. So just kind of listen through it. You don't really have to take notes or everything. It's all written down, or you can hear it in any format you like. Presentation, not a problem, because you've already got it. Questions, though, please do feel free to call or email me, and I always get back to you right away. The problem. For this slide, I want to talk about what I think is the problem with trainings from 3 different perspectives, and why training in its most common form is not enough to make a difference. First, let me talk about my own story. I've been to a dozen camp trainings at 11 different camps. 11 different camps from start to finish. That means I was there from very first day to the very last day of camp, the whole summer long, and I was able to see the effect of training in reality at all these different camps. In addition, I've been to 6 residential trainings that had nothing to do with camp, and a dozen non-residential trainings that had nothing to do with camp. So what I'm telling you is I'm a camp and training junkie. What I've noticed from all of this training is that what happens in training is not often what happens in reality. And I'm sure you all are witness to this yourselves. No big surprise. But I've also witnessed the elements that help improve the relationship of what happens in training and what happens during camp. This is what I'm personally bringing to this presentation. Beyond that, I have the scientific studies that have been done for decades on literally millions of people that illustrate what staff training best practices are. So now let's move on to that. For the camps, studies of summer camps, there aren't that many of them, but let me talk about a few major ones here, some that are really illustrative. 97 different scientific studies of outdoor education programs. These are primarily outward bound programs. And there was a meta-analysis, which means that someone went through and examined all these scientific studies of these outward bound programs in a scientific way. There's formulas, there's procedures, the scientific method. And they went through and they said, okay, how effective were these programs overall? And they said, well, overall they were okay. But when they went through it, they said, well, clearly some are better than others. About half did a really good job and about half not such a good job. And one of the key factors that they teased out was staff training was a critical difference. Second point, 37 camps' ability to influence self-esteem. This was a study that Paul Marsh did. Again, it was a meta-analysis, so he looked at 37 studies that other people had done, scientific examinations of camps. The results of these 37 studies were that camp essentially did not change self-esteem, did not improve self-esteem. There was an effect, but it was so small that it was really insignificant. Scientists measure these things, and they call them effect size, and they measure them kind of on a scale from like 0 to 1, in little fractions in between. So 0.3 would be a small effect size, 0.5 kind of a medium, 0.7 kind of a large. And the effect of camps was in the neighborhood of about 0.1, 0.2, which is smaller than small. Not very good. In fairness, it is very, very difficult to improve self-esteem, but nonetheless, that's extraordinarily noteworthy. The third point, one camp. They studied over 17 outcomes in a very rigorous scientific way. This camp had a 1 to 3 counselor to camper ratio, a 1 to 9 supervisor to counselor ratio, a 2-week training, which is exceptional, and a 3-week session that the kids went to. Now, the results of these 17 outcomes were that only 12 to 15% of the children walked away with any significant effect. The rest were no different from the control group, from the children who were studied who didn't go to camp. Only 12 to 15% walked away with a significant effect. And this was true even after attending the camp for 3 years. One of the key variables, one of the key factors that explain this result was staff training. Okay, let me pause for just a moment here. So what am I telling you? What have I just told you? Although camp can most definitely change children's lives, it takes an exceptional camp to do so. Sure, you've got to have a great program that is capable of impacting the children and staff. But after that, you've got to have the people to implement your great program. The camp is only so many buildings and trees and frogs and such. It's only so many computer files and binders. It's the people who breathe life into the program and make it real. The staff are the camp. Those staff are the people who create the culture and change lives. Let me say that again. Those staff are the people who create the culture and change lives. Those staff have to have the skill, the knowledge, the attitude, and the behavioral ability to do it. Making sure that the staff are trained so that they have those skills is what separates effective, exceptional camps from those that are just playing in the sun. The hiring process is absolutely key, but college students very rarely have most of the skills they'll need to be instrumental in the children's lives. They must be trained and trained well. If college students could do it through the normal training process, the normal hiring process, these 97 camps, these outward bound programs, the 37 camps, this one camp I'm talking about would have done a better job. What I'm telling you is that the evidence to date shows that camps, outward bound, other programs frequently don't achieve their visions and missions. They aren't changing lives like they want to, or at least as many as they would want to. I also want to tell you that camps are in great company with these results. Parent effectiveness training, Fortune 500 companies, and the DARE program are just some examples I want to go over with you to further illustrate my point about how vital training is and how difficult it is to do it well. Although all of these case studies show follies, they also will illustrate, as throughout this presentation, what was fixed. And those are the important lessons for all of us. Those lessons are the bulk of this presentation. Those lessons are the universal training principles that apply to human beings, whether it's at a camp, a large organization, working with kids in drug education, or the many other examples I'll discuss later. So let's start with the parent effectiveness training. Basically, the model is this. Every other weekend for 3 months, parents go and they spend all day getting trained on parenting skills. They're trained in behavior management, they work on themselves, all sorts of various parenting skills. The results are that it was 60% of the people who went through the program were more effective parents, dramatically so, but 40% were no more different than those who had never even heard of parent effectiveness training, the control group. Well, they figured out how the training had fallen down, and they fixed it. They went from 60% effectiveness rate to a 95% effectiveness rate, and I'll tell you how they did it. The Fortune 500 leadership trainings. Fortune 500 companies spend roughly $1 billion a year. The figure is probably actually quite a bit higher than that, but this is kind of a guesstimate that people often use. And it's now called the $1 billion mistake, because often people, these Fortune 500 companies, spent all this time and money on training and it didn't work. So, how did they determine that it didn't work? Well, they decided to study the effects of training as a consortium project. And they spent about $3 million doing it. So the Fortune 500 companies got together and they're like, you know, we should really check this out. We're spending $1 billion on training. What is it really doing for us? So they hired universities, consultants, they utilized the government, massive study. In a nutshell, 90 to 95% of the people who went through training were no better off than those who hadn't gone through the training. That is not very encouraging. However, what is encouraging is that the study also pointed out how they could improve their training. I also included a recent article that sort of glances over this for you for your interest and amusement in the handout. So the DARE program. DARE stands for Drug and Alcohol Resistance Education. And in 1993, 4.5 million children had gone through the program. What was the result? Well, they changed the knowledge of these kids. They knew a heck of a lot more about drugs. They knew the drugs' effect on their bodies. They knew how people got started using drugs. They knew the long-term effects of drugs. They just knew all about drugs. But it had no effect on their attitude and no effect on the behavior. When they followed these kids, even up to 2 years out, going through the DARE program was, in terms of attitude and behavior, useless. Completely useless. Several different studies showed it. So they went back to the drawing board and they fixed it. How they fixed it is part of what I'll be telling you throughout the rest of this presentation. Okay, go on to slide 5. The point is that it is hard to change people and to train staff well. It is truly very difficult. Slide 6. But it isn't impossible. DARE was fixed. Leadership trainings can work. Parent effectiveness training models were fixed. We know why some outward bound programs worked well and while others did not. These principles, the best practices in training staff, are universal. And your camp can understand, slide 7, what went wrong, what went right, and have your training match or exceed best practices. Okay, please go to slide 8. All for one and one for all. That's the cry of the Three Musketeers. And these are also the three elements to a best practice training. And this is the structure for the whole presentation. Knowledge, attitude, and behavior. So you'll see the KAB framework on the left of every slide. You just can't have one, and this will be clear throughout. You have to have all of them. It is one for all and all for one. So let's start with knowledge. Knowledge is just the book learning, the mental understanding, having it all in one's head. Very important, but alone, it isn't enough. Knowledge is a necessary but insufficient condition. Let's take the example of Dale Carnegie trainings. So Dale Carnegie wrote this book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Fine book. So some people decided, well, you know what we'd really like to do is take this book and train people in it. So they started this whole thing, and it's national, and they train people based on these ideas. And here's how they do it. Go over 8 weeks. You come in on a Saturday, and you spend all day, and they lecture to you, and you read things, and you do role plays. So they thought they had this fabulous model, and so they went out and they hired some people to evaluate the program, a couple people, in fact, different places around the country. And they said, okay, we want to, you know, you to tell us how well we're doing. And their expectation was that they were doing fabulous and that they were going to use these results to market their program. Well, what happened is the results of the evaluation showed that almost everybody could not be differentiated from folks who hadn't gone through the program. That is, even up to a year out, you couldn't tell someone who went through the Dale Carnegie training versus someone who didn't. So what do you think they did? They buried the results. They dug a hole and they buried them. But eventually they surfaced, and so now we know about it today. Their approach of knowledge, primarily in role plays, didn't work. Camps that sometimes just target knowledge probably aren't going to be that successful either. The second point, attitude. Attitude is selling their hearts and souls. It's converting them. It's getting buy-in. But attitude alone isn't going to be enough. Let me tell you a quick story. So there's this hospital that hired me to conduct a study. And their question to me was this. They said, Randy, we want to know if massage helps our employees. So what we want you to do is, you know, they got about 500 employees to give all of these people a massage, 1 hour massage once a week for 6 months for free. Not me personally. I hired a bunch of massage therapists to do this. And their question was, does this help the employees' physical health, mental health, and job performance? So here's what I did. I sorted everyone by last name. And I took every other person, so that's fairly random. Half the people got the massage, half the people were the control group. And I measured everyone, those who were getting a massage and those who weren't. Measured blood pressure, their stress hormones, took blood, did anxiety tests, job performance based on their own ratings of themselves, a supervisor's ratings of them, their peer ratings of them, and subordinate, if appropriate, ratings of them. Very, very comprehensive 360-degree performance evaluation, measures of happiness, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, what happened? Well, they were very happy with the massage, as you might imagine, and they were happier with the company for giving them one. They also had lower stress levels for about 24 hours and blood pressure. After that, you couldn't tell someone apart who had a massage, who didn't have a massage. And there was no job performance gain. So why is that? Well, what they did is they targeted attitude. There was no knowledge component or no behavioral component. They didn't teach them anything new to go with this, and they didn't give them any more skills than they already had, the behavioral side. So all they really had was the change in the attitude. It just made them happier and took their stress down for 24 hours, but that alone didn't transfer to behavior. They were already working hard and fairly happy with the company. So the gain in attitude wasn't really going to get them anywhere in and of itself. Attitude alone does not equal behavior. Attitude alone does not equal behavior. It's just one component. A very, very, very crucial one, as we'll discuss soon. But it's just one. It's all for one and one for all. The behavior side is the doing it. It's the practice, practice, practice. It's the skill. It's the in the trenches. And we're going to cover this in such detail later that I'll just come back to this later. Okay, on to slide 9. Knowledge pitfall. A lot of people focus on knowledge, even though knowledge alone isn't enough. For example, among industrialized countries, America is the most overweight, workaholic country in the world. This is a United Nations study, and congratulations, we win. Despite the fact that we know better. We know what a healthy lifestyle is almost better than anyone. And yet, we are the most overweight workaholic country in the world. Think about this. McDonald's. People know McDonald's isn't health food. Suppose you were to walk into your local friendly neighborhood McDonald's and tell all the people in line, hey, guess what? This is bad for you. It's not health food. This isn't good. Nobody's probably going to get out of line. People know McDonald's isn't health food, and yet people still eat it. Okay, the second point, high-risk HIV candidates. Whether in the United States or in Africa, people who know how the disease is contracted still get it. Knowledge about how the disease works is not enough to prevent people from engaging in behaviors that get them the disease. Seatbelts, recycling, speeding, again, knowledge is not enough to stop people from doing things. DARE, again, the children understood all about drugs, and yet, before it was revamped, it didn't change their attitude or their behavior. Okay, on to slide 10. Knowledge is a necessary but insufficient condition. If knowledge were enough, self-help books would be the answer to many of our problems. Commercials would save the world. And unfortunately, I've seen many a camp approach training from a mostly knowledge standpoint. But it is incredibly necessary. So, I'm going to spend just a moment on enhancing knowledge. First, I have to say, camps need to give themselves a round of applause because they do a great job of enhancing knowledge. Usually a camp program will involve the counselors in the learning, they'll keep it playful and moving, they'll respect and utilize the knowledge of the counselors, they'll cover a ton of material in short order. All of these things are usually done very well. There are a few tweaks that I've seen that could probably help make camps do an even better job. And the only one tweak I'm going to really talk about in the presentation is something called 7 plus or minus 2. There are other tweaks in the handout which are equally important. So if you go to slide 12, you'll see a graph. And the graph has age on the bottom. So from a 2-year-old to a 7-year-old to a 12-year-old to an adult all the way on the right. And then on the left are the number of items people are asked to remember on a daily basis. So you can see a 5-year-old can remember roughly 4 items or so, plus or minus 2. A 10-year-old can remember roughly 6 items, and an adult can remember about 7. Now, the plus or minus 2 is because people vary. So, the average adult can remember about 7 items. A below-average adult could remember only about 5, and an exceptional adult can remember about 9. So, why is this key? If you go to slide 13, you'll note that it works its way into society all the time. Telephone numbers are 7 digits. Magazine lists. Stand in the checkout line at the grocery store and take a look at the magazine list. You'll see if it's something they want you to remember, it's probably the 3 such and such, the 5 such and such, the 6, the 7, but usually it's not any longer than that. Recite a top 10 list. Try and think of any top 10 list you've had. They're extraordinarily hard to remember. To illustrate that this is working memory, because it is possible to remember things that are longer, but it's hard to work with them when you're memory. So take, for example, 10 first names. Just think of 10 people you know, their first names. Now alphabetize that list by the 3rd letter. That is working memory. You have to think about it in order to do it. It gets really hard to do such things when there are more than 7. Try and remember 2 license plates. It's hard to do. Sticky notes. 3M and Post-it notes has made a fortune based on the cognitive principle that people aren't going to be able to remember more than 7 things. If we could, we'd go to the grocery store and really wouldn't need a list. Last point here is that under stress, it goes down. The Red Cross knows this, and so they have their ABC, airway, breathing, circulation. Because if somebody's under stress, they are going to be able to remember those 3 things. An emergency, it's 911. It's not an 8-digit number. So the next 3 slides, from number 14 now, are excellent behavior management advice. However, that advice violates the rule of 7 plus or minus 2. And B, Is it best knowledge? And maybe hopefully you'll get some attitude out of it as well. It isn't behavioral training. You have to keep that in mind, and this will be clear as we go through the rest of the presentation. Okay, slide 15. Behavior management summary. This is a summary that one camp gave its staff. It was actually a couple slides longer than this, or many more points, but I'll just give you this as a flavor. So let me go over just a couple of these. The first up here in the upper left is to react calmly in an uncalm situation. A couple down, to keep behaviors from escalating between levels, try and contain them at the lowest level of appearance. To diffuse situations whenever possible without confrontation, up to the upper right here. Do give yourself time to make good judgments. Do treat everyone with dignity and respect in the middle. Do be consistent and persistent in maintaining behaviors and standards. Do use educational interventions, and do remember that all behavior is communication. Great list, but this violates the rule of 7 plus or minus 2 up and down the block. All you're going to walk away from with this is a gist, and a gist is not good enough. You can't work with a gist. Role-playing some of these would probably be helpful, but role-plays are not good enough, and we'll talk about this later. For one, even if you were to role play these, you'd miss the larger picture. Now, I have a whole article on behavior management and the 5 approaches to it, and it's in the book, so check that out. But you need a larger picture. Your brain needs a way to organize this information. So let me recap. If it were effective, knowledge would be enough. Remember the Dale Carnegie example, though. Knowledge alone is a necessary but insufficient condition. So let's go on to slide 16. Staff training foundations, 10 ways to be successful. This is from Dr. Thurber. So here are his 10 tips for staff. 1, really get to know each camper. 3, listen to campers' feelings, label the feelings, and reframe. 5, respond to problems thoughtfully. 7, keep children your top priority. 9, use safe touch and avoid overstimulation. 10, lead by example. It's a fine list, and he goes into quite a bit more detail into all of these. But counselors, or anyone, is not going to be able to remember all of these because it violates the rule of 7 or plus or minus 2. And if you can't remember it, your brain isn't going to try, and it will just attempt to capture the gist. So if your brain's forced with a list and it says, subconsciously thinking, I'm not going to remember all this, so just take the gist of it. Not what you want to happen. Let me reiterate very strongly here, though. Knowledge alone is insufficient. And even if you can get people to remember lists, knowledge is only one of the 3 keys to the kingdom. Furthermore, lists are rarely useful when you're actually doing something with the knowledge. You have to have a working knowledge. When human beings are working with knowledge, the number of items or concepts, the number of balls Homo sapiens can have in the air at any given time, is roughly 7 plus or minus 2. Again, take 7 people's last names and alphabetize them by the 3rd or the 5th letter. That's a working knowledge. When people are in the process of doing, working with a child in some way, a supervisor having a conversation with a counselor, you're talking with a parent, whatever the task, don't expect people to be able to use the knowledge you've given them very well unless it fits 7 plus or minus 2. Or it has to be practiced so much that the brain has it down cold turkey and doesn't really have to think. That takes an extraordinarily long time. Extraordinarily long time for that to usually happen. Okay, on to slide 17. 9 points for understanding and changing behavior. This is from Bob Ditter. All behavior is code. If a child can't tell you, she or he will show you. 3, state what you expect in simple, positive terms, and don't tell them what not to do. 5, learn to channel a child's energy. Use diversions and be creative about assigning activities. 7, rule of replacement. Not this, that. So if somebody's doing something wrong, say, it's not this, instead, do that. 9, select a target behavior that the child is most likely to be successful in. Okay, again, all good principles. If you have more information, or if you'd like more information about behavior management, please see that chapter for more. Okay, let's go to slide 18. 15 ways to improve self-esteem. These are more lists that are unlikely to be remembered and used. The 20 immutable laws of parenting. The 10 alternatives to punishment. Part of the problem and part of the solution. This one camp had this list, about 30 items per page, and one page had part of the problem. You're part of the problem when, and then a long list of things. Another page had, you're part of the solution when, and a long list of things. People were only going to walk away with the gist of this. Last thing, 12 things to remember when disciplining a child. Okay, these are all fine. Good things to remember, good things for people to kind of go over and keep in their head as a gist. But people aren't going to remember this. Working memory is what we're talking about. Certainly, people can remember long lists. They can remember a list 15 items long, 20, 50, even 100 items long. But they aren't going to be able to work with that knowledge, and that is the key. Remembering and working with lists are not the same thing. Now, the little caveat here in the lower right is it doesn't apply to habits and established routines. Because when it's a habit or an established routine, your brain kind of goes on automatic pilot and it doesn't really need your working conscious memory to be figuring things out. That's why often, you know, lifeguards, they practice things so many times that they don't really have to remember the 32 steps necessary to save somebody because they've done it so many times they can just kind of do it. And reference material. Referencing things is fine, especially after the fact or right before something's going to happen. So that's, you know, perfectly useful. But if you want people to work with it without referencing it, that's a whole nother ballgame. So 7 plus or minus 2. Slide number 19. What are you going to do? First, keep it to 7 or less for working knowledge. The second bullet here is an example. The acronym is iEscape, and this is a behavior management model that has a structure to it and is 7, so it works. I, isolate the child. E, evaluate the child's perspective. So have the child tell you their side of the story. S, share your side of the story. C, connect the behavior to the feelings. A, come up with alternative plans. P, pick the best plan. And E, enter the child back into the group. iEscape, people can remember. Third point down, so much practice that it comes naturally. Now, this requires an enormous amount of practice. But if somebody's done something so many times, if it's longer than 7, they're going to be able to do it because it just comes naturally and it's ingrained to them. Okay, let's say you're violating the rule of 7 plus or minus 2. Anything you can do about it? A few things. One, try distributing it on business cards one point at a time. So you can buy these really cheap Avery business cards now, feed them through a laser printer, put one principle on it, one thing you want them to remember, and put it in their mailbox every day or every other day. People will get that. It'll be a reminder. It won't be overwhelming. If you've got a daily schedule, put the reminder of the day on it. How Gumby Saved the Children. Now, this is a story about how Gumby, who's this, you know, flexible kind of stick figure green thing, how he emotionally, physically, playfully, and with his incredible flexibility, saved the children. Now, this director told this story once, and it was enthralling, it was incredible, it was full of adventure, it had everything in it, and people were able to remember that story. So then, they just threw Gumbies all over camp, and kind of had this, you know, refrain, remember Gumby, be flexible, and remember how Gumby, what would Gumby do, you know, and that was just kind of their thing, and so people were able to remember a lot of the things that Gumby did with just the idea of Gumby. Lastly, utilize as a reference. So if you've got the 20 alternatives to punishment, and a counselor's used punishment, or you want to give them some ideas of what they can do, it's helpful to sit down with that list, with a mentor, and go over it. Or right after an event is another great time to reference this kind of thing. So somebody's tried to discipline a child, didn't work that great, they need some other ideas, sit down, reference it. That's a fine way to use the information as well. Okay, slide 20. Let's recap the knowledge key. Knowledge is a necessary but insufficient condition. Remember, the example of the people who are high risk of HIV. Remember the example of, you know, we are the most overweight, overworked, industrialized country in the world, despite the fact that we have knowledge of what's a healthy lifestyle. 7 plus or minus 2, this one little tweak to help the training and the knowledge. Try and keep things you want people to remember down to 7. It doesn't apply to reference material or habits, and then I provide you with a few workarounds. There's other ideas in the handout that are beyond the 7 plus or minus 2 principle that are excellent additions and will really help the counselors be able to take the knowledge in and use it. So I invite you to please read that. Okay, on to slide 21. So this is the outline. So you can see on the left we have the little KAB framework here. We're now done with the K and we're moving on to the middle A here. So what is an attitude? This is what the first thing we're going to cover. Then why do camps need to care so much about it? And then how can attitudes be enhanced? So that's the framework for the few slides that we're going to go over under the A. Slide 22. Attitude is the effective emotional element. It's selling the heart and soul. It's an internalized belief that enables someone to have constant striving towards a goal through specific behaviors. So, attitude is, you know, how you feel about something. And it falls along a continuum from weak to strong. So, people feel, you know, so strongly about organic food. And people feel so strongly about whether or not TV is a good thing or not. People probably feel really strong about abortion. In order for somebody to use the knowledge and have it translate into behavior, it has to go through attitude. They have to want to do it. Same, simple as that. You want attitude to translate into behavior. It's very hard to get a strong attitude. It is incredibly difficult. So go on to slide 23. This slide is absolutely key. Knowledge is present, attitude isn't present, not going to translate into behavior. Again, America is the most industrialized country, but we're also the most overweight workaholic in the world. High-risk HIV candidates, media in moderation. The average child watches 40 hours of media a week, the equivalent of a full-time job. Yet, most parents and children know that they probably shouldn't be watching that much TV. Adults watch about 20 hours of media a week, in addition to a full-time job. 27% of the ACA vote turnout. So this was for the 2001 vote, and it was for national board members, presidents, and other people. And this went out to members of the American Camping Association, people who should care about camping. Now, only 27% voted. That's less than the national election. You know, we're voting for president, 50% turnout. Only 27% of the membership voted. Now, at camps, I'm sure folks are telling people, you know, it's important to be involved in your community. Voting is a civic duty. That's why we're doing these things at camp. We're doing these civic acts. We're being active. This is why recycling is good. You know, this whole greater good and being active and participating in one's community. And yet the people who are espousing this, only 27% turned out to vote. Knowledge is not turned into behavior. The attitude, which is extraordinarily difficult to reach a level high enough that the knowledge translates into behavior. Very difficult. Seatbelts. 68% of the adult population wears a seatbelt. This is incredible. It's not that people don't understand what a seatbelt is for. You're not going to walk into the hospital, candy striping, pop into a room where someone was hurt because they weren't wearing their seatbelt, broken leg, brain injury, and say, "Hi, you know what? If you had just worn that little seatbelt, that little dangly thing over your left shoulder, if you had just worn that, you wouldn't have all these problems. Chances are, statistically, you'd be okay." The person sitting in the hospital bed is unlikely to say, "No, you mean I wouldn't have had to have my leg amputated, I wouldn't have a brain injury, wouldn't have all these problems, I wouldn't be cut to pieces. If I'd only used that little dangly thing above my shoulder? Is that what that's for? No, you're kidding. This is not the reaction you're going to get. People know what seatbelts are for. Recycling, speeding, the DARE program, parent effectiveness training. Again, the knowledge is present. The attitude is not present to a significant enough degree to translate into behavior. Attitude is very difficult to reach a critical point necessary. So, what do you do about this? Go to slide 24. First and foremost, you have to preach to the choir. So these next six slides are about how to enhance the attitude of your staff. You have to believe when you step on the camp the first day that camp is going to give kids a world of good and that they are there to do it. The counselors are there to help the children. That attitude has got to be really strong and positive. If it's not there, the chances are very, very slim you're going to change it. You have to be preaching to the choir on the first day. Don't assume that because you hired the staff, their attitude is sufficiently strong. Remember all the things just talking about on the former slide. The attitude is very difficult to reach a high enough level. Second point, they already know it. They don't need this anymore. They came here and they've been babysitting for years. They were here last year. They're a sophomore in college in the teaching program, or they're a senior in the psychology program, and they already know what you're going to tell them, and they don't need to be there and listen to it. Or they went through staff training last summer, so they don't need to do it again. What are you going to do about these kinds of problems? Well, if they went through staff training last summer, it helps if you can get them active in training. So they're part of it. They're the teachers. They're really involved and they're set aside as mentors. That'll help a lot because when you try and teach something to someone else, you really learn it and understand it better than ever. Second little bullet point here, the wisdom to realize they probably don't know it. Often people come in and they're like, I know it, as I was just saying. So how do you convince them that maybe they should keep an open mind? I don't have the time to go into it here, but there's a story, an orientation story that I have that you can print off and read. It works really well as a demonstration, and that can often really help drive home the point that people need to keep an open mind. The last point, the maturity to accept that they might have it wrong. If you run into this problem and you've got staff that really can't accept that they might have it wrong, try using the believing and doubting game. It's in the book as well. Print it out. Try using it. You'll probably find a great deal of success with it. Last point here, inspirational stories from parents, children, past staff, and yourself. Sprinkle these generously throughout your orientation and the whole summer. So you've got this letters from parents who said how incredible the experience was, how much Johnny or Jane improved, and how different they are now after coming back. Save those letters and read them to the staff, and don't read them all in one fell swoop. Sprinkle them out here and there throughout the summer. Letters from children. If you've got the letter from that child who said how much he loved camp and how much difference it made in his or her life, save those letters, which I'm sure you do, and read them out, sprinkle them out throughout the summer. Past staff, same thing. And yourself, why are you here? This is a really hard job. You probably don't get paid that much. You're working essentially 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 months. You have no time off. You're working like a dog. Why the heck are you doing it? Tell them, speak from your heart and from your soul why you're here and why you're doing it. That is incredibly powerful. Okay, on to slide 25. Remove structural barriers. These are key. These will really help your staff in that it will lift sort of this burden that prevents their attitude from surfacing or translating into behavior. First, sleep deprivation. We all know this, and it's a camp staple. It's a problem for a couple of reasons. One, when you're tired, it's harder to care. When you're tired and you're really hot, it's even harder to care. It's also hard to learn. Give you a very quick example. There was this study with rats, and they used this thing called functional magnetic resonance imaging to watch their brains as they ran a maze. And they could see how their brain was learning. They could see where the rat brain was active and where it was storing the information about how to get through the maze so they could get the cheese. Okay, all that's well and good. Then what they did is they let the rats sleep, and they woke them up a couple hours early. They woke half the rats up a couple hours early, and the rest they let sleep, watching their brains the whole night through with the functional magnetic resonance imager. Turns out that when you sleep, during the last few hours, you practice what you learned the previous day. So if you wake up early and you're sleep deprived, you don't learn as well. For the rats who slept the whole night through ran the maze the next day twice as fast as the rats who only got a couple hours less sleep. And they could see when the rats were sleeping that they were practicing the maze. They could see this so precisely that they could tell you at what point in the maze the rat was at while they were sleeping and practicing. Incredible. Other things. Temporary time crunch. Situation is a crisis or overwhelming. Again, these things tend to be camp staples. Very long hours. Inability to meet personal needs. You know, if you hear people say things like, oh, I just can't think. Or, I know, but I didn't have the time. The situation prevents them from doing what they know. And if it's a crisis, or it's overwhelming, or it's long hours, they stop caring because they don't have the time to. They also might bring a crisis mode attitude to the next problem. If they're really feeling frustrated and they've got too much to do and they're overwhelmed, it's that kind of attitude and intensity that they might bring to the next situation that comes up. The military has learned this very well. For example, the military did this study where they were trying to figure out why it is that despite the fact they do training over and over and over again and role plays and practices, that often it wasn't enough. People, when it got stressful, when folks were under pressure from time or stress, the training tended to go out the window and they would just kind of do what they know. They just went with their gut. That's not what the military wanted. They didn't want people to go with their gut. They wanted them to go with the training. So what did they do? They decided, well, the only way to get that to work is to train people so well that their gut is the training. So they go through the training in as real a situations as possible so many times that it finally becomes their second nature or their habit. Now at camp, that's really not an option. So you have to kind of remove these barriers. Very important. Staff motivation. It's much harder to care when the staff are generally not motivated or when an individual isn't motivated. Attitude comes at such a high price that you don't want staff motivation to hold people back. Last three things here, parent effectiveness training, leadership training, and camps. The parent effectiveness trainings found that when parents were in a crunch, they didn't use their training. The leadership found the same thing. When you're in a crunch, you tend not to use any of the information that you learned. Camps have found the same thing. When the barriers are not there, folks are more likely to put into practice what they know. Okay, on to slide 26, the base of power used. First here is monitoring external rewards and punishment. Now this is the philosophy of many prisons. Let me give you a quick example. There's this one camp that had this counselor who was extremely enthusiastic and just all gung-ho and was a great counselor, but he didn't exactly have the best leadership characteristics and the best judgment. So he would tend to play practical jokes on the kids, and many of these weren't necessarily appreciated, but the counselor didn't really get that. Good counselor in general, a lot of enthusiasm, So what happened is the supervisors got together, the unit head, the director, the assistant director, and the counselor. They got together, sat them down in the office, and they outlined the problems, and they said, what's going to happen is you're now on probation. And if we find another instance of this behavior, you'll be fired. And this is going to remain on your records for 2 years. So if you come back, it'll be on your record next year. But if you come back for a third summer, then we'll forget this ever happened. Do you have any questions? Now, how do you think that went over? Well, it did change this counselor's behavior, but that the counselor wasn't as enthusiastic. And they didn't help. It didn't help the counselor become better at their job. And, as you might imagine, the counselor didn't return the next summer. Now, again, this was an enthusiastic counselor, generally good counselor. The kids really liked him, had the potential to be better, but the monitoring, external wards, and punishment sort of killed the attitude. The better way to do it is to target the values, the hopes, the dreams, and the goals. And this is the philosophy of effective interventions in camps. It's not controlling from the outside, it's pulling from within. Its chances are you likely have the same ends, the counselor who is having a problem and the camp. But they're just not finding the right way to meet them. So that counselor was trying to have fun and trying to be fun with the kids, but they weren't exactly doing it in the right way. So if you start with the end and work backwards, it's much more likely to be effective. The counselor would have walked away, changed, and energized. Now, it takes time to do such a personal approach, but there really is no substitute, and it helps attitude enormously. Okay, on to slide 27, understanding how camp helps. So at the end of training, how many of your staff could write a complete list of the outcomes your program offers participants? So it's the end of training, you sit everyone down with a piece of paper, and you say, okay, what I'd like you to do is to write down all the benefits children receive from our camp. Now, at the end of the summer, you have the same thing. How many of them do you think would be able to write down the list? Which ones, and if they're in a complete list, and then which ones do you think they might leave off? This is a very enlightening exercise. I've done it several times. Chances are you'll be surprised. Second little group here. At the end of training, how many of your staff do you think could identify how camp went about achieving each of those outcomes and what their role was in it? How about at the end of the summer? This is an incredibly eye-opening exercise. I highly recommend you try it. The point here is avoiding the cog in the machine problem. And let me explain this by way of example. If you go to slide 28, you will see a process map. This is for responsibility. So camp on the left leads to responsibility on the right through the things in the middle. So starting from the bottom, camp encourages the children to take responsibility for their own behavior, has group decision making, and has the child participate in several chores, say sweeping the dining hall, gardening, setting up a campsite, waiter or waitress, making the bed, and cleaning the bathhouse. So I was walking down with this group of kids, this camp, and they were going off to clean the bathhouse. Everybody, every day, had a short chore to do to help keep the camp up. And it happened to be this cabin's day to clean the bathhouse. Now, they were not excited to do this. And one of the kids, as he was walking down, was like, oh, man, this sucks, man. This camp's so bootleg. God, we paid a lot of money to come here. They should just hire someone to do this. Man, this sucks. Now, the counselor responded to this. And he's like, come on, you just need to do it. Let's just go for it. Come on. Tried to get the kid excited about it, which, as you imagine, didn't really work very well. And the kid just said, come on, let's just, you know, this just sucks. I mean, God, I'm not coming back this year, next year. Ugh, they should just hire somebody to do this. How come they don't, man? And the counselor said, well, I don't know. Look, this is just how it is. We just have to do it, all right? And if you complain, it's going to take that much longer. So let's just get on with it, do it, and then we'll have time to go off and do the things we want to do. This is not the response you would have hoped the counselor would have offered. You would have hoped the counselor would have said something like, "We all live in a community, and we all need to contribute, and this is our job today. Everyone does their job. Everyone has a chance of doing the good jobs and the jobs that aren't so pleasant, like cleaning the bathhouse. It's a nicer place to live when we all chip in. It's cheaper to attend the camp. So if everyone just does a little bit of work every day, more people can afford to come, and your parents have to pay less. And if they were really good, they could relate it to the greater society and say, you know, the same is true with recycling. If everyone does a little bit of work, it's much better for everybody. If everyone votes, it's much better for everyone. If everyone does their little jobs for the community, works out better." Now, the kid didn't get that the chore was important for the camp community. They didn't know why they were doing it and why it was important. Likewise, the counselor wasn't able to explain that to them. Now, the process maps are one way to help counselors understand their part in helping the children receive the outcomes. And there's a whole presentation just on process maps, which I hope you'll look into. Let's go on to slide 29. So this is the last slide in enhancing the attitude, 6 of 6 here. The first thing is a termite. Now these termites, they're little, lovely little insects. And what they do, as you know, is they weaken the frameworks of houses and other things. But they don't exactly eat the beams in half. They just sort of weaken it from within. And it kind of looks okay if you look at it from the outside, which is why you need a termite inspector to come over. But when you look closely, it doesn't look very pretty. Camps and large organizations alike have the same problem. They all have termites. So what is a termite? It's a staff member who doesn't really quite buy into everything. Or maybe they don't quite buy into just little aspects. They don't really like the behavior management, or they don't really like the curfew. Little things. So after you explain the rules to someone, or you're telling them how to work with children, or some aspect, you're trying to convey something. The people walk off down the wood path after this is over, and the termite's like, "Oh, that's not how it really is. You can get away with that." Or, "Oh man, I'm not going to do that." Or even worse is if you have a returning counselor, and they say, "You know, that's what they say, but here's how it really works." That is a king-size termite. And returning counselors are often the ones that set the culture. Okay, so what do you do with this? Have termites on your list. So when the supervisors sit down to review the day, say, "Who are the termites? Has anyone found any termites? Catch them quick." Majority rules. In a small group situation, let's say you have three counselors in a cabin, and you have one weak counselor and two strong ones. Well, if you set it up like that, it'll probably work out good, because the weak counselor is going to be outnumbered and is probably not going to be able to sway how the cabin works. And because they're in a group with two stronger counselors, they might even change that person's mind or prevent them from doing a bad job. Either way, you're better off. Now, on the entire camp scale, if you've got a majority of people with the attitude who are gung-ho and want to work for the camp, and want to work for the children, and want to have fun, you've got that critical mass, that 100th monkey, that synergy, whatever you want to call it, that really helps the attitude as a whole. So, slide 30, let's just quickly recap. What is an attitude? Went over that. It's the feeling, it's the heart and the soul, it's your thoughts about actually doing something. What doesn't qualify for sufficient attitude? Remember, 27% of the ACA members voted. 68% of the adult population wear seatbelts. We are the most overweight, industrialized country in the world, despite knowing better. Attitude is extraordinarily difficult to come by. How do you enhance it? Preach to the choir. Use inspirational stories. Deal with the people who already know it. remove the structural barriers, target when there are problems, the individual, the small group using values, hopes, and dreams, that base of power, prevent the cog in the machine mentality, catch the termites as early as possible and address them, and use majority rules to your favor. If you've got those things working for you, you'll have done almost as much as you can to have attitude in your favor so that what you're telling them will actually translate into the behavior. So speaking of behavior, let's go on to slide 31. So now we've gone through the knowledge component, the first box on the upper left. We just finished the attitude component, the middle box here. Now we're on the last one here, the home stretch, the behavioral side. And this is absolutely key. This is kind of, if I had to pick one element where people fall down the most, where all these programs fall down, it is the behavioral side of things. So this is crucial information. First point, knowledge plus attitude equals dedicated novice. That's what we're going to talk about first. Then we're going to go into role plays, then jumping with a bungee cord, talking about modeling and scaffolding, and finally go over a few other caveats. So without further ado, please go to slide 32. Knowledge plus attitude equals dedicated novice. So what do I mean by that? Let's take the first example here, a child learning to ride his or her bike. So the child has the knowledge. The child is, 13 years old. It's the next Einstein, understands perfectly the physics of how bicycles work, could explain to you the gear ratios and the percent of effort that translates into forward motion, everything. And they have the attitude. This child is like, I'm going to ride this bike if it kills me, and I totally want to do it, and it's just, this is my whole life, I'm going to ride this bike. This child is a dedicated novice. So if that child gets on the bike without any assistance, chances are it's not going to be very pretty. With adults, try it with a skateboard, folks. I've tried it, not very pretty. I might really want to ride a skateboard, and I might understand how skateboards work, but I'm going to need a lot of practice before I'll be able to do it. So knowledge and attitude are alone only give you a dedicated novice. The teacher for your child. The way education system works usually is a teacher will have the knowledge through university. The attitude is hopefully there. They really want to be a teacher. And that makes them a dedicated novice. So what do the teacher training programs in the country do? Well, good ones will have the teachers in the classroom apprenticed to another teacher for a minimum of 1 year, and sometimes as many as 3 or 4 years. If they go on to their master's, even more. So it's that apprenticeship that really works, that changes from only having knowledge and attitude to being a dedicated novice, to actually having the practice so that they're capable of doing it. The surgeon for your heart. What is the training for doctors in this country? Well, you go through medical school and you get the knowledge. And then hopefully you have the attitude that you really want to be a doctor. But you really wouldn't want someone as a surgeon after they had the knowledge and the attitude. They really need the practice. Hence, residency is evolved. Last, the camp counselor for your child. You don't want the counselor who just has knowledge, maybe from university or from orientation, and the attitude that they want to do a good job, to just go out there and do it, because chances are they are a dedicated novice who doesn't have the experience necessary to really be instrumental in a child's life. If they did, all these things that I was talking about before, these studies, would have had better results. So on to slide 33. The best practice is apprenticeships. Improving emotional intelligence. There is a book by Daniel Goleman who wrote Emotional Intelligence, and he's just come out with Working with Emotional Intelligence, another book. And he studied organizations and methods around the country for training people how to be more emotionally intelligent. And you can get that off the web. He offers it for free. If you let me know, I'll give you that location or send it to you. It's freely available. But in essence, he advocates apprenticeships as pretty much the only darn thing that works. Teachers, we went over. Medical doctors, counseling psychologists are the same. What do? Well, they go through 2 years of graduate school. And while they're getting the knowledge, they're also sitting in with other psychologists and practicing by themselves eventually so that they get that experience, behavioral experience up. So they're not a dedicated novice by the time they finish their master's. Even so, most people will be more comfortable with a counseling psychologist who's practiced for a decade than someone who has their diploma from 1 month ago. Most sports, you know, it's not a classroom education kind of thing. It is the practice, practice, practice. Driver's education. Insurance companies give drivers who have been driving longer better rates because they're better at it. You know, and this is a statistical fact. Because knowledge, you know, you don't, you know, it's the teenager who studied the DMV book and can go in and take and pass the test does not get a license unless they've had a little bit of driver's education, in most states now anyway. It is the historical norm. A squire would be apprenticed to a knight. You would be apprenticed to a carpenter. You would be apprenticed to a blacksmith. You'd be apprenticed to a tailor. Apprenticeships is the historical norm of how it works to train people. And it's how people are trained well today. It's also the basis of how camp helps children. This is a key point that I think should just be blasted from the mountaintops, and that the American Camping Association should just be screaming at the top of their lungs, making this point. And it's a generalization, but it's still an important one. At school, children have knowledge. They're getting a lot of knowledge about things. They're sitting in rows getting knowledge. Sometimes they're getting knowledge by doing things in great schools, but still, they're often learning about physical things or history. They're learning about knowledge they're doing. At camp, children are learning by doing to be better people. They're learning social skills. They're learning emotional intelligence. And they're not learning it through books. They're learning it through doing it. And they're learning it through doing it with people who care about them and who are going to try and help them do it better. That is why camps are so crucial in our society and how they fill this need that isn't really met in most schools in the country. Okay, on to slide 34. The knowledge plus attitude, K plus A, equals dedicated novice. This is the difference between street smart and book smart. That's why returning counselors are usually better. It's the old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. It's why smart people do dumb things. And it's why employers ask for previous experience, especially in the trenches. Okay, slide 35. Normal trainings are insufficient. So let me recap and make this point again. Fortune 500 leadership trainings. 90 to 95% of them didn't work. The billion-dollar mistake. So what went wrong? Well, they focused too much on knowledge and on role plays and sometimes on shadowing, just modeling. What they did to fix it? They implemented more in the trenches, real behavioral training using scaffolding. And they also did a better job of attitude and increased the sort of modeling component, the shadowing modeling component. There's 37 camps and self-esteem. Again, let me throw in the caveat, it's extraordinarily difficult to improve self-esteem. Even so, the effect was very, very small, so small that it was meaningless. We don't really know what went wrong based on these studies, but staff training was certainly a factor. Parent effectiveness training. So, they were 60% effective, which is pretty good. They had a lot of knowledge, a lot of role plays, did a lot of targeting of attitude, and it was an extraordinarily long training time. So that was in their favor. However, even with all of that going on, 40% were no different from those who'd never attended the program. So what did they do to fix it? To get it up to the 95% effectiveness rate for their trainings? They found out they needed to remove the structural barriers. They needed to get rid of the things that were hindering these people from implementing what they learned. That was a major point for parent effectiveness training. Also, they started doing real behavioral training with an expert on hand in the homes. And that was the key. Those two factors in particular were the keys to getting parent effectiveness training up to the 95% level. 97 outdoor education programs, Outward Bound primarily, they went to an apprenticeship model. That was pretty much their main effort, straight out apprenticeship. That one camp with a 1-3 counselor to camper ratio, 1-9 supervisor to counselor ratio, and a 2-week training. That camp doubled their effectiveness in 1 year by implementing the things I'm talking about today. And they'll probably get better and better as the years go by. So let me reiterate, the vast majority of counselors that come to you are dedicated, hopefully, dedicated being the attitude, novices. If that weren't the case, you would have expected better results in all of the above. You would have expected Fortune leadership trainings to be more effective if people weren't novices. You would have expected the 37 camps, at least a couple, few of those, to have done a better job, because those were a wide range of camps represented there. You would have expected parent effectiveness training to have an even larger success rate. You would have expected the 97 outdoor education programs, primarily Outward Bound, to have done a better job. You would have expected not such a dramatic increase in that one camp, who was already won an Eleanor Ells Award, not the shabbiest camp in the country, to not have been able to double its effectiveness by implementing these elements. Let me add that hiring is key. Bob Ditter is doing excellent work with a hiring process. And if you can hire somebody that is already, in essence, trained, coming to you trained, that is great. But it's very difficult to staff a camp with people who are already experts in the things they need to be. Very difficult to do. If it were easy, these 37 camps would have done a better job influencing self-esteem and all the results I've been talking about today. So the vast majority of counselors that come to you are dedicated novices. The novice range probably goes, you know, up and down, but you know, the people you hire probably aren't at supervisor level. And I think that's probably where most of them need to be, at least a majority, if you're going to be an exceptional camp that's really going to change the vast majority of kids that walk through the doors. Now, this is entirely doable if you're using the best practices training model, because you'll have a return rate, hopefully, of around 50%, and those people will have essentially gotten in the trenches training the whole summer using best practice methods. So when they come back next year, in addition to the experience they gain outside of the camp, they probably will be at supervisor level when you use all of these methods. Therefore, it isn't that difficult once you've got this whole process in gear to have a camp that has a majority of people who are masters and who are able to be instrumental in changing children's lives. What is the best way to practice and learn? On to slide 37. Well, one approach is role plays. But as the title says, if you do role plays, you're playing dice. Role plays are very good for breaking up the lecture, for making learning more fun, for creating aha moments, providing pseudo-practice, facilitating understanding, and changing attitudes. However, slide 38, they're limited because there's a very small amount of practice time. Role plays are not practice that, you know, happens over an extended period of time. And it's often with, you know, a facilitator who's running around trying to catch lots of people and give feedback on a very quick, limited basis. Another problem with role plays is it's intuiting the periodic table from a few chemical elements. Now, this could be addressed, but frequently the way it works is in a role play is you're given this situation, like in s'mores and sticky, other sticky stuff, this kind of thing, and you solve a problem, but you're not given the sort of the larger framework. So it's very hard to be effective without that element. So with this example, it's like telling you, here are the symbols for, you know, oxygen and gold and mercury, et cetera, et cetera. And then trying to intuit the structure and the other elements of the periodic table. Very difficult to do. Impossible, in fact, most of the time, accurately. But that can be addressed. Third point, it is time consuming. It is very difficult to fit in a lot of role plays. For example, in this presentation, to go through and do role plays for many of these points, although it would be fun and it would break things up quite a bit, would be extraordinarily time consuming. You know, instead of being, you know, well over, let's say, over an hour, almost 2 hours for a presentation, it would be, you know, a full day or 2 days. That might be valuable, but most people are under time constraints. Finally, the main problem with role plays is they aren't real practice. You don't want the President of the United States to be someone who has role played that. You don't want the teacher, someone who has role played it. You don't want the surgeon to someone who says, okay, you know, I've tried this a few times in a simulation. You don't want the pilot of the plane you use to fly around the conferences or to visit family or whatever to say, yeah, I have 50 hours in a simulation. No, you don't want the director of the camp for the children to be someone who is role-played it in the basic camp director course. And you don't want the counselor for the children, the people who are trying to change their lives, to give kids a world of good, to only have role-played it. It's not very effective. If it were, all these other programs would have done a much better job than they did. So what do you do? Slide 39. Jumping with a bungee cord. Okay, so first let me explain that. What I mean by jumping with a bungee cord is that, you know, if you picture this, you've been to New Zealand, you've seen this on TV, you got the bungee cord, the elastic big rubber band tied to your ankles, you jump off this platform, and just before you go splat in the river or on the cement, you boing back up again. So this is the same in training. It's great when you're asking the counselors to jump in there with the kids and to help them out and to change their lives. But if they get into trouble, you've got to have somebody there who is the bungee cord who can pull them back or can jump in there and help them. So the first option in trainings are self-study, you know, sort of this behavioral practice, getting this in the trenches experience. And self-study is not so effective because it follows the principles of the School of Hard Knocks or bootstrapping. So the School of Hard Knocks is you just bump around and you get bruised and scraped and beaten trying to figure out the path through the way. Bootstrapping is you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And as the analogy indicates, that's pretty darn hard to do. So it requires an enormous amount of attitude as well. Attitude, as we just were talking about, comes at an extraordinarily high price. It's very, very difficult. It is more precious than gold. We don't want to tax people's attitude any more than necessary. There are many wrong turns. It's like going through a maze without a map. And also, people might go through this maze and think they found the end, and it might be a false end, and they wouldn't know it. So they might be doing a completely wrong thing with the children. They think it works for them, and so it's fine. It's also very slow. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of effort. And you might make all sorts of, you know, wrong turns, as we said, and just end up in the wrong place. So the better choice is option B, modeling and scaffolding or coaching. And that is what the remainder of this presentation is going to be about, how to teach people, give people the behavioral side of this trilogy with modeling and scaffolding. So if you'll go to slide 40, please. Modeling. We all know what modeling is. It's a pretty universal concept. It's when somebody expertly demonstrates the skill. Expertly is key. Has to be expertly demonstrated. Experts are pretty hard to come by. So let's say you've got yourself a few experts, hopefully, and they truly are, and more about this is kind of in the handout, and they demonstrate the skill. That's great. It's even better, not so often done, but it's so useful if people will process the experience afterwards. So if the model is working with the child and trying to deal with the behavior management situation, and the counselor is there watching it, watching the model do it. Afterwards, they sit down and they talk it over. What just happened? What did I do? That is incredibly powerful modeling. Now, when does modeling work? It works when the student has seen it enough. And what's enough? A whole heck of a lot, usually. It takes a very, very long time for most people to learn anything from just modeling. It's a particularly, you know, it's faster than the school of hard knocks and, you know, self-study, but it's still an incredibly cumbersome, difficult way to learn. Now, this isn't true. Well, I'll just go through the list here. So the second down point is the attitude to learn and use the knowledge is strong. It requires the attitude, as we were talking about before. It also requires the knowledge behind the skill is present, as we were talking about earlier. At least some kind of lay knowledge is extraordinarily helpful when watching a model do something. It helps you frame it in your mind. More about that in the handout. Second to last point, the difficulty of the task is easy. So it's no great shakes to flip a coin. But it's incredibly difficult to learn how to effectively deal with children who need social skills enhancement or whose self-esteem is low. It's harder than you'd think. And if it weren't so difficult, these programs that I've been talking about would be there. If it were so easy, 90 to 95% of the people who go through Fortune 500 leadership trainings would not be indistinguishable from people who never set foot in one of them. And finally, how close the student already is to mastering the skill. So if the person is, you know, 90% of the way there, modeling might help get them that last little bit. Okay, let me just make the point that modeling is very, very valuable. And the apprentice method, though, is not just modeling. You can't just model being a teacher, a surgeon, a director, or a counselor. You need practice. And guided practice is best. And that is scaffolding. And that is going to be on slide 42. But let me make one more point about modeling on slide 41. And that is, it is also useful because it sets and reinforces cultural norms and values. And so this on a larger than individual level, this is modeling is incredibly beneficial. Bob Ditter calls it the parallel process. And what he means is how you work with staff is how staff will work with the children. The second point is you teach people how to treat you, how to treat each other, the children, and the camp. Now, this is an incredibly powerful concept if you just let it sit and just work its way into your brain a little bit. You teach people how to treat you. If you can accept that, all sorts of relationships in your life will become much clearer and a whole new way of looking at them will appear. If you just think, you've taught people how to treat you. Third point is that often if you're going to have a modeling set and reinforce the cultural norms and values, you need a majority of people to be doing it. Now, that's often the case, but not always, because you can have extraordinarily charismatic people, and that'll make a difference. But in general, having a majority is necessary. On a small group level, it can work as well. But then again, either the same rule applies. It either needs to be someone charismatic, or it needs to be a majority within the smaller group. I want to caution you here that modeling is an incredibly valuable tool. Incredibly valuable. It's essential, but it is slow. And it's almost always insufficient in and of itself. Modeling is not mastering. Let me say that again. Modeling is not mastering. Sometimes it is. Flipping a coin, you can model that and someone's going to master it. But for almost anything worthwhile, modeling is not mastering. But it should definitely be done and done all the time. Okay, scaffolding, slide 42. So again, as I was saying before, the apprentice method is not just modeling. It's guided practice. And scaffolding is the scientific word for guided practice or for coaching. Now, coaching is kind of this general word that has gotten all sorts of connotations to it. So scientists have decided to call it something different to separate you know, kind of this general nebulous idea of coaching to that of scaffolding. And so, in essence, scaffolding is coaching by helping out. And when one helps as little as possible. And the goal is to create independence in the student. So let me tell you why scientists have called this scaffolding. Or let me give you an example that will help illustrate it. Think of a scaffold next to a building. It helps the worker reach a higher level on the building and complete some work that they couldn't do without the scaffold's help. So they can climb up and they can do some work to an area of the building they wouldn't be able to reach without the help of the scaffold. A coach, a scaffolder, provides the help so that the student can achieve a certain goal or reach a certain level. And this lets the person get used to performing at that higher level so that eventually they'll be able to do it by themselves with the help of the scaffold, without the help of the scaffold or the coach. So, again, the scaffold is just this temporary help that's provided as little as possible so that the person can get used to performing at a higher level. When that help is no longer needed, it is withdrawn because the goal is to have the student be independent of the scaffolder or the coach or the teacher. Now, the one key here is that the skill has to be within the reach of the student. You're not going to teach a child to talk at 3 months of age, no matter how much you scaffold the concept. It requires the person to be, you know, within the realm of their abilities. If not, all the scaffolding in the world is not going to help. Okay, let's go on to slide 43. A scaffold is a temporary support to achieve a specific goal. And there's all sorts of things in coaching, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just going to go way out on a limb here, even though it's supported kind of by science, that there's pretty much four elements to coaching specifically, with a couple of other principles thrown in for good measure. So again, scaffolding is a temporary support to achieve a specific goal. And the four things that are involved in scaffolding, or also known as coaching, are to define the task, to have the student think it through, offer praise and understanding, and to modify the task so it's within the person's grasp. Now, this is a tool belt. That's why I corrected myself. It's not first. These are four tools in the teacher's or the scaffolder's or the coach's belt. They shouldn't be followed in a lockstep manner. This is simply, you know, someone with super coach dressed in tights, and when there's a problem, he flies in, zips down, and looks at his belt and sees what's necessary. He's got defining the task on his left hip. He's got have the student think it through on the right. He's got praise and understanding attached to his chest and modify the task to his arms. So these are just various tools, and the coach kind of looks at the scene, or the scaffolder, super coach, whatever, and says, okay, what am I going to do? Which one should I use for this situation? It's not using all of them, and it's not using them in a lockstep order. It's using which one is most appropriate and providing limited assistance only when it's required. So for the last point, let me start with, I'm going to go through a few examples of this so it's clear. But for the last one, provide limited assistance only when it's required. It turns out that people learn better when they try it themselves with help when necessary. So if the kid is going down the street on his bike and he's learning how to ride it, you don't want to help them ride the bike or straighten out unless it's clear they're going to wipe out. If they're struggling a little bit, if they're a little wobbly, that's okay. They're learning, and they're learning better because they're wobbly. Now, if it's clear they're going to wipe out, or they're going to give up out of frustration, then some help should be provided. Okay, so let me go through a few examples so this is clearer. Archery. So it's modeled, the the kids get on the scene, and the archery instructor models him. He fires a few shots. He explains how it's all done. The kids watch him fire a few shots. Of course, modeling isn't sufficient, so they're not going to hit the bullseye like he did every time, or she did. So, the kids are giving their crack at it, and it is then the coaches, the archery coach or scaffolder's job, to step in and provide help. So, a kid's trying away, and clearly is just not making it. So, the first thing the coach might try, and again, not in a lockstep order, but just for convenience, is define the task. So, he might say, you know, your arm is bent, and because of that, your arrows aren't getting the distance that you'd like them to. So try straightening your arm and see how well that works for you. Simply defining the task. Straighten your arm, that's better form. Have the student think it through. Okay, so let's say that students fix that problem, and all the arrows are kind of going up and to the right. You say, well, are you aiming? And they said, yes, I'm aiming. So you see, you know, they're hitting the target. They're just all up and to the right. And so have the student think it through. You know, first, are you aiming? Yes. Okay. Well, where are you aiming? Well, I'm aiming at the bullseye, and they're all going to the upper right. Okay, so where do you think you should aim? So you're aiming at the bullseye, right? And you put the tip of the arrow on the center yellow of the bullseye, and the arrow kind of goes up and to the right. Well, you seem to be doing everything okay, so what do you think you should do in order to have the arrows hit the bullseye? Answer, you're hoping for, is that they'll move their aiming point to the lower left of the target, which results in the arrows going into the bullseye. Okay, so that might sound a little condescending and pedantic in this, you know, kind of straightforward example, but it usually works out just fine, and people kind of have a general knack for this. Praise and understanding. The kid's trying away, shooting away, missing the target left and right, first try. Praise and understanding. You know, Johnny, most people miss 20 or 30 arrows before they hit the target. Let me work with you. Let me watch you. I know you're going to do it. Stick with it. Just have fun. And if you hit the target within the first 30 arrows, I'll be really impressed. That's offering some praise and understanding to help the person kind of get through it. Modified assistance so that the task is within the grasp. Person's still having trouble, so the scaffolder or the coach might say, you know, I can see that you're having a little difficulty here. Why don't we move the target from 20 meters to 10 meters and work on your form? It's easier to hit the target from there. It's easier to see what's going wrong and what's going right. And once you get it kind of down, then we'll move the target back and try again. Modifying the task so it's within the grasp. Behavior management example, there's one in the handout, so I'm not going to go over that. So let me give you another example with a counselor training a counselor in training to lead children on a hike. So they're going along, happy as can be, and the line is starting to get a little bit straggly and a little bit strung out. Now, it was modeled how to handle this situation, and the knowledge is there. The CIT has the attitude, they really want to do it. They're lacking in the behavior department, and it has been modeled, but it's not working with just modeling. So the super counselor, scaffolder, coach person steps in and, let's say, starts off with defining a task. Again, not in order, just for convenience now. So the kids are really straggled and sort of separated here. We've got, you know, some fast people in the front, some slow people in the back. You know, what do you think we might be able to do here? And that kind of gets in first, pointing out that the kids are straggled. Maybe it didn't reach the counselor's attention, the CIT's attention. Define the task. Second part was having the CIT think it through. So we need to get everyone together so we're safer and we can keep track of everybody. You know, what might we be able to do to get everyone together? Again, sometimes this sounds condescending and pedantic, but in reality, it works out really well. So maybe the CIT says, well, we should get the slowest hiker to be at the front and have them set the pace. Great idea. If they remember that, then that's probably going to work out well. And that might be all that's necessary. If not, let's say you're stepping in and you say, okay, well, maybe they just need some praise and understanding. They already know these things. They're trying it. It's not working out very well. So the first tool the counselor whips out is praise and understanding. you know, this is a really hard group. They're really wired after quarantine. You're doing a great job. Just stick with it and let me know if you want me to help. The fourth, modifying the task so it's within the person's grasp. So let's say these things aren't working, or maybe this is the first thing to try, and because he sees that the CIT is having loads of trouble, so he tries modifying the task so it's just within his grasp. So the counselor says to the CIT, okay, I'm going to go ahead and hold everyone up at the front of the line and try and talk to and then I want you to try and talk to everyone about the expectations for a hike. And if you need any more help after that, I'll provide it. You don't let the person fall down. So say, okay, I'm going to hold the group up and you're going to talk to them. If you need help, kind of give me a long stare and I'll jump in and help. That's modifying the task just enough so it's within the person's grasp. Now, if it completely just falls to pieces, all these things, and it's clear it's not going to work, maybe some more modeling is necessary. And again, modeling by an expert completing it with the student watching and then processing it through afterwards is a key modeling step. Scaffolding is done with when it's within the person's grasp to do the activity, whatever it may be. So if you go to slide 44, you'll see we've gone through the example of archery. Working with a distressed child is in the handout. Training CIT to lead children on a hike, we just went through that. Working with new office staff, not going to go through the rest of these examples. These are just sort of illustrations to get you thinking. But working with new office staff, it's much more effective. You hire someone on the job to give them training by doing something real and by having that person have a coach or a scaffolder available if they need it. Much better than the school of hard knocks, kind of, you know, oh, just come in, make yourself at home, you'll kind of figure things out. Much slower. Executive coaching, there's this whole huge organization that's sprung up. There's books on the topic now, massive amounts of people doing this. They're in the yellow pages. It's just this whole area that's really sprout up. And executive coaching is a lot, not so much modeling, it's pretty much almost entirely scaffolding. And they go through the same steps, these four steps that I was talking about. And I shouldn't probably use the word steps because, again, it's not a lockstep manner of any sort. But they use these tools, these scaffolding tools, to help executives. That relationship that you had, you know, it's often the case if it's that one person in a relationship is better at something and the other is better at another. This might be interpersonally, this might be physically, whatever. And you teach each other. You act as the model and the scaffolder for each other. And if you think about it, it's really an incredible thing that happens in relationships, is that you sort of bring each other up in the areas that you're weaker in, provided that you have a good scaffolder, you know, as a mate. Assistant director to the by the director. Again, scaffolding needs to happen all the way down the line. The expert needs to model and scaffold with the person who is a lesser expert all the way down the line. And the director should probably get somebody else to come in and do that with them every now and then. Supervisor with the counselors, parents with children. This is the way training works. This is what works. Slide 45, scaffolding. Let me reemphasize that the vast majority of counselors are dedicated novices, and modeling alone is not going to cut it. If it did, the 97 Outward Bound type programs would have had better results. 37 Camps in Self-Esteem, again, there's a whole host of different kind of camps. You name it, one of those camps was probably in there, would have had a better effect. That one camp that doubled their effectiveness by implementing these principles. And lastly, all the common sense examples under the dedicated novice. How people are trained historically. Teachers now, surgeons now, driver's education, you name it. This is how people learn. Okay, slide 46, making behavioral training the standard. First point is have the unit heads or the supervisors or whatever you call them in the groups training the counselors. These people are doing the modeling and the scaffolding. Now, I find that it doesn't work well to just sort of send them forth and say, go forth and model. Go forth and scaffold. I find that works pretty badly, actually. So I've come up with another method, because the former was just, it's just too loosey-goosey, and, you know, they just go out there, and they kind of see how's it going, and some do it well, some do it don't. So I've developed a structure, and I put that structure in your handout, and people can go through that, supervisors, unit heads, whatever, and they'll know what they're checking for. They already know about modeling and scaffolding, because you'll have told them about that, and they'll be looking for the opportunities to do that. So use the handout and the page and give that to your supervisors and adapt it as you will, but it's a good structure and good format for them to use when they're going out, and so that they've got things to check for and things to do instead of just kind of being generally there. The hours, 2 hours every day to start with, and 1 hour every 2 days after that being with the group. Now, this is a broad rule of thumb because camps are very, very different. And what might work well for one camp in terms of time might not work for another. Also, there are so many different situations that camps have that it's just difficult to state. So that's a broad rule of thumb, 2 hours every day to start and an hour every 2 days after that eventually, when they're better. Second bullet point here is supervisors model and scaffold with unit heads 1 to 2 hours per week. And this happens all the way down the line. So it should be that the expert is always modeling and scaffolding for the lesser expert, the director with the assistant director with the unit heads with the counselors, and the counselors with the children, all the way down the food chain. And if you're at the top of the food chain and you're the expert at camp and you're the director, then try and find somebody else who might be able to come in and help you with things. Now, in reality, the director can be helped by other people because people are experts in different areas, so it happens up the line as well, because it's not the case that a supervisor is expert at everything. They could probably learn a thing or two from the counselors under them. Third point, highly skilled counselor in every group. This is great if you can manage it. If you can get a really incredible counselor, someone who is almost of amazing supervisor quality, a true expert, if you can get that person in the cabin living there, then they are the modeler, they are the scaffolder, they are the, you know, coach that's in the group on an almost constant basis. And it helps if this person sees themselves this way and they can do it informally. It's very difficult to find such a high caliber person that will work in the cabins. It's rare to see this in practice, but it's incredible when it happens. And if you're using, after you know you implement the best practice training methods in your camp for a while, and you get your return rate of counselors who have been brought up to a high level of skill, and a bunch of them come back to be in the cabins, this will be more so the case. There are several more ideas in the handout, but in general, if you've got the ideas of modeling and scaffolding down, then you've been taught how to fish, so to speak, and you can think of all sorts of ways to adapt those principles to your camp and to implement them there. Okay, slide 47. In-services are insufficient. Right. So knowledge plus attitude, as we were talking about, equals a dedicated novice and does not equal someone, almost always, who is skilled at behavior unless it's extraordinarily simple behavior. In-services, the way they're frequently run is the person or the teacher has a group of counselors during the summer, and the kids are gone, or the kids are away, and it's just a group of counselors and the supervisor, and they're training. Now, this is kind of just like orientation. So what happens is, they're targeting the knowledge. They're targeting the attitude. They might be doing some role plays for the behavioral side of things, but that's really all they can do. So in-services are insufficient because they are not the key modeling and scaffolding activities that need to be happening. Second point. Outsource, hired, check. This is the problem when camps hire people. You know, you hire the Michael Brandwine, you hire the Bob Ditter, you hire this training guru person to come in and train your staff. That's great. They probably are going to do a fantastic job of it. They have a lot of experience. Remember, they have the knowledge, hopefully. You assume they do. They've got the attitude. They really want to come, and the money probably doesn't hurt that attitude. And they really want to help instill behavior in these people. And they've got the skills. So they've probably had, you know, been to loads and loads of camps and tried many times and honed their ability to train staff. Great. However, what they're going to do is target the knowledge and the attitude and the behavior through role plays. That's all they're able to do. They might be able to model the parallel process. How they are with you is how they want you to be with the children. So that's kind of a, you know, pseudo modeling activity. But that's really as far as they can take it. And as we were talking about, this whole presentation, even if they can give you knowledge, if they can instill attitude in you by buckets, great. But without the scaffolding and the modeling in the trenches, as we've been talking about this whole time, it's not enough. It's not enough. So outsource, hired, and check is not going to cut it. You've got to have that training happening all the time. Last point here, if at first you don't succeed, try, and then give up. Okay, so what I mean by that is you've got a counselor and they sat through orientation and they're like, woohoo, this is great, I love it, I've got the knowledge, I think I got it now, and I really, really want to help. And they go off and they try and help the kids and it doesn't work so good. So they're like, okay, but I really want to do it, I got a lot of attitude here, okay. They go off and they try, and oh darn, you know, bless their hearts, it doesn't work so good. And so they're like, okay, I really want to do it. So they go and ask their supervisor for help. Okay, I need some help. And the supervisor's like, oh, well, try this, and this. And they go back and they try it. And oh, well, kind of worked a little bit. Oh, okay, it doesn't work so well. Oh, darn. So they've now tried, and at last they're going to give up. The problem with this is for this person to give up, changes in their mind. It makes the whole thing a whole new ball game. For them to go back and use a method that has failed for them several times is an enormous Herculean task. Scaffolding, watching for the failures, and being the bungee cord that catches them before they go splat is key. That is what's going to prevent that. If at first you don't succeed, try, and then give up. Because when they're trying and when they're failing, there's going to be someone there who's that bungee cord who's going to help them succeed. Okay, 48. Take home points here. Knowledge is a necessary but insufficient condition. All these points we were talking about. You know, you need to have the knowledge. It helps enormously. Loads of information in the handout about this, but alone it's insufficient. And then we talked about a little tweak, 7±2, to help people use the knowledge that you give them. Attitude is crucial, but it's extraordinarily difficult to obtain to a sufficient degree. It is more precious than gold, more precious than platinum or saffron. It is just the sorcerer's stone. Because, remember, 27% of the ACA membership voted, 68% of the adult population wear their seatbelts. Attitude is difficult, but anything you can do to improve attitude will definitely be paid back in spades. And we went through at least eight ways to improve attitude. Behavior. Knowledge plus attitude equals a dedicated novice. Role plays are great, but they are sort of a fake way of practicing and all the other problems with them. But there's many, many benefits to role plays. Great, great, great tool, but can't be relied upon as the only tool in the chest. If it is, chances are things aren't going to work out that great. Modeling and scaffolding are the keys. They're where it's at. They are what we spend a lot of time just talking about, because they take the knowledge and the attitude, and instead of a dedicated novice, you have somebody who's eventually doesn't need the scaffold anymore. They are the master. They are capable of doing it, and they are helping to change children's lives in a way that was unprecedented before. 49. So, these are training, staff training best practices. And you can take it from the Fortune 500 who have come up with this model. You can take it from the DARE program who spent millions of dollars trying to fix it, who came up with this model. You can take it from the Parent Effectiveness Trainings who, again, independently, now they all came up with this solution largely independently, went through and tried to figure out what was wrong, came up with this model, went from 60% effective to 95% effective. Outward Bound. Daniel Goleman, on a totally different track, was trying to figure out how to get people to be more emotionally intelligent, came up with these exact same principles. Bob Ditter, Michael Brandwine, you can read their materials and kind of get, you know, this kind of gist out of it as well, and they would certainly agree with these principles. And Ditter, even in his book, wrote kind of about these principles and on a very high kind of level without all these details. Or you can take it from that one camp that implemented these processes and doubled their effectiveness in 1 year. And I'm sure they're going to continue to get much, much better as they get much, much better at this themselves. Or you can take it from me, someone with their doctorate in psychology, who has studied these processes. Whoever you decide to take it from, these are staff training best practices. So where do you take it from here? Don't worry, there's no quiz. Just use the handout as a checklist. There's more in there than just a checklist. It's a sort of a narrative of this in a way, provides even more detail than I was able to give in this presentation. Examine your structures. How does orientation address the knowledge, attitude, and behavior component? Across the board, when camp is happening, include time for experts to train. So you want to make sure that throughout the summer, modeling and scaffolding is taking place, and it's down the line. The director does it with the assistant director with the unit heads with the counselors. However it's set up, experts need to train lesser experts all the way down the line. Lastly, assess your ongoing training methods. If you're using in-services, please don't rely on them. In-services are insufficient. So sometimes people will listen to this presentation and they'll say, Randy, or Dr. Grayson, where are the specifics? So I've thrown in a slide here for you. Knowledge, slide number 19, there's 7 points there. The handout has 4 additional major points to it. The attitude, there were 8 points on how to influence attitude, slides number 24 through 29. For the behavioral side of things, modeling is explicitly described on slides 40 through 41, and scaffolding on slides 43, 44, 46, and 47, and there's much more in the handout as well. So there are the specifics on the knowledge, attitude, and behavior. In addition, I'd like to make the point that this is a valuable framework that you now have. You've listened to this. You've earned it. You've got this framework. This framework is incredibly valuable. Use it to evaluate anytime anyone is trying to convey anything. Evaluate me. What did I just do? Well, I tried to give you some knowledge. I tried to change your attitude about how training works and why it works and what is the best practice. Was I able to really convey any behavior? No. I didn't do really any modeling or scaffolding with you all, and we didn't do any role plays. So really all I did was the knowledge and attitude. The behavioral side in a presentation format like this is fairly impossible, especially if you don't want to just drag it on forever. Thank you very much for listening to this. From the bottom of my heart, I appreciate the fact that you listened to me drone on about staff training best practices for almost 2 hours. I hope that you will take this as an investment. An investment that will pay off as soon as possible in helping the campers and the staff members get more out of the experience than they ever did before. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact me.